Something invisible shifted in 1979 during the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. Standing at my window, nothing looked different. Same trees, same sky, yet the air itself had transformed. An unseen force created by human hands, happening miles away, had fundamentally altered reality for everyone. Years later, TMI acquired a second meaning: too much information. The coincidence feels almost prophetic. We're living through another invisible transformation, one dispersed so uniformly across our lives that we barely notice it happening. We adapt with remarkable speed to technologies that promise ease and connection, yet resist acknowledging how profoundly these choices reshape who we are. The screens in our pockets have changed us as surely as any nuclear cloud. Only this time, we've welcomed the transformation with open arms. Picture two men standing in the same spot, watching someone approach. Adam lives in 1700s Boston. Zeno is his modern descendant. Though biologically identical, their experiences couldn't be more different. Adam's world is immediate, tactile, grounded in physical reality. Zeno's consciousness has expanded outward, but thinned, his sense of presence diluted across countless digital connections. The weight of objects and events has somehow lessened. We're drowning in data that only becomes meaningful when given context. The balance has tipped from Adam's embodied existence to Zeno's disembodied data space. Modern life entangles us in systems we believe we need, but that increasingly separate us from direct experience. Distance once meant genuine mystery, what Walter Benjamin called aura. Constant connectivity has collapsed that sense. I resist buying a cell phone to preserve the friction of geography, the meaningful effort of contact. I won't surrender to perpetual availability. These digital networks proliferate through invisible codes, interlocking and never simplifying, advancing by constantly creating more data through wireless networks that surround us like an atmosphere. My first GPS experience proved unexpectedly unsettling. Though I understood the technology intellectually, I found myself wondering, how does she know, as the voice guided me through unfamiliar streets? I anthropomorphized it easily, wanting to please her with correct turns. The next day, a headline asked, "Does anybody still use Siri?" introducing Google Now as superior. This relentless pattern, more, faster, better, cheaper, creates perpetual obsolescence. Google executives speak of just building the dream when describing predictive technologies. That casual just betrays a presumption of inevitability, as if they're fulfilling humanity's destined evolution rather than creating tools. Most disturbing is the assumption that technology companies will lead us forward and users will have to get comfortable with whatever they create. Who granted them this authority? Kevin Kelly's vision reveals where this leads: a universal digital library where every bit informs another, every page reads all other pages through algorithmic connections, essentially forming a vast collective brain. The original Persian tale of serendipity celebrated finding valuable or agreeable things not sought for, a vital human capacity now under threat. Serendipity requires attention and recognition, seeing familiar things anew in changing circumstances. Preference algorithms create profiles based on past choices, while instant search provides immediate answers where none existed before. These technologies shift us from initiative to obedience while stealing mystery, that uncertain unknown which is our birthright. When we gaze at the night sky and feel reverence, we're experiencing the immense unknown as a philosophical premise of being. The old ways of discovery required patience. Finding connections between artists might take years rather than milliseconds, but that investment gave experiences substance. GPS exemplifies our surrender of agency. Unlike map reading, which demands interpretation, GPS solves everything for us, commanding rather than guiding. This technology banishes lostness, not a trivial inconvenience, but a metaphysical category bound up with authentic being in the world. We've transferred reliance from self to system, believing ourselves cradled in a data field. When these systems fail, our panic reveals the chasm between their capability and our ignorance. Search and present technologies have transformed from miracles to assumptions, bypassing trial and error learning while feeding illusions of competence. Our brains rewire rapidly, consolidating new reflexes while retiring obsolete ones. Yet the journey of discovery might actually be the point of living, with those serving as pretexts for having experiences. I've developed a defensive shield when going online, an exclusionary scanning technique to counter the unremitting neural disquiet the internet creates. This medium activates persistent deferred expectation, as if that unnamed thing I'm seeking is always just a finger tap away, the root of a lowercase addiction. Online reading demands constant mental counterpressure to resist the keyword-driven, hyperlinked structure that propels lateral movement rather than deep engagement. The digital age celebrates collaborative knowledge-making over individual expertise, with Wikipedia as its flagship. This represents a stark cultural choice, the individualized self versus the socially collectivized self, where eventually the very concept of self must blur away. Thinkers from spiritual visionaries to Kevin Kelly have imagined collective selfhood. Against this, Jaron Lanier warns the hive mind is for the most part stupid and boring, and cautions against devaluing individuals. As Marshall McLuhan observed, we create machines in our own image, and they, in turn, recreate us in theirs. Kelly's vision merely projects what's happening, electronic merging that levels individual quirks into collective patterns. Watching IBM's Watson dominate Jeopardy felt profoundly depressing. Not knowledge versus knowledge, but human understanding against raw calculating power. Watson answered questions about Charlemagne with the same inflection as Alka-Seltzer, reducing all information to undifferentiated data. We project humanity onto Watson despite knowing it's merely circuits, relating to it as if it possessed lived experience rather than algorithmic probability. Steve Allman's article about iPads in his children's school revealed our culture's reflexive mockery of technology skeptics. His disclaimer, "It's not because I'm a cranky Luddite, I swear," shows how genuine concerns about corporate intrusion and isolated screens get dismissed. We've created a culture where questioning technology requires defensive apologies. The critical question is whether screen stimulants erode our interaction with the unmediated world. Do these magical devices dim our sense of wonder at the world beyond the screen? Previous generations believed struggle built character, that attainability and desire were inversely related. When making these calculations for our children, we're ultimately asking, what is the point of living? If techno-competence becomes the ultimate key to advancement, what picture of meaning and purpose does that leave them? Andre Kertész's photographs of readers capture people in moments of private freefall, through the inner landscape. Nothing so vividly depicts the split between bodily and mental as the engaged reader, who has vanished from their environment, transported completely. Those images of children with books evoke that lock-on intensity that wanes as we age, when the world competes more aggressively for our attention. The novel isn't merely something to study, but a field for thinking, a condensed time world adjacent to ours. Its purpose might be less about communicating themes and more about igniting inwardness, an enhancement, a deepening, a way of priming conjecture. The novel offers a vital antidote to